and you would have said, hey, that's not simultaneous. So the fact that it appeared to be simultaneous says that it's either very close, like within 20 feet, or it really was a direct direct brain pickup, if you know what I mean. Let's see what Richie's got to say about all those. Richie, start off with your call letters, because there's quite a few guys that sign in who call themselves Richie. And which one are you? Go ahead, Richie, with your additional information.
Repeater.
Yes, Kilo Charlie to Lima Tango Yankee. Copy.
Sure do, Richie. Now I know which one you are. Go ahead with your comments.
Back in the day, late 70s, it was an 11-meter antenna, and I was hit by lightning, no radio connected. I was out in front of the house, and when I went back into the house, I had a fire in the basement, and I had two water leaks.
So you had disconnected the radio, but the feed line from the antenna did go to the basement, but even if it didn't. The fact that the lightning struck your house. Direct lightning strike on a tower, an antenna, a house, in general, it's going to do damage. The more you put protection devices, lightning protection devices, the more you limit the damage, but you can never completely eliminate it. That 11,000 to 100,000 amperes of a lightning bolt, if it directly strikes anything in your house or in your backyard, in general, it's going to do some damage. So it's created a fire. Again, I want to know, did the feed line from the antenna go to the shack, to the basement where the fire was, and to create two water leaks? I'd love to know what actually was leaking the water. Was there a sudden pinhole in the pipe? Back to you, Richie.
Yes. There was fiberglass insulation. The paper was in the ceiling. The coax cable was near there, and near copper water lines. And apparently, it arced. I wasn't there. It arced from the cable to the water lines, and it started the paper burning on the insulation. Put a hole or two in the water line, and the cable was laying on the concrete floor, and it made a black spot about the size of a silver dollar or a little larger. And I was outside in front of the house, no rain, while the event took place.
Yeah, that's one of those clear blue lightning bolts. They're kind of rare. How bad was that fire, and what did you have to do to put it out there, Rich?
Believe it or not, the water leak took care of that, most of it. When I was outside to walk in the dog, and I came back into the house, and small smoke ran into the basement, and the water was spraying, and that was more or less the end of the fire. But like I said, there was no ground on the cable or the antenna. It came into the house through the concrete wall, draped over a water line, was very near it, within 6 inches or a foot, and it arced and set the paper on fire of the insulation, and burnt a hole or two into the copper water line. And it burnt paint on the bathroom floor, the concrete floor. So that was one hit, which I know of a fact. And I have been hit more than once.
Yeah, kind of curious where you live, Rich. There are certain portions of Long Island, like, for instance, a northern portion of Glenwood Landing? Nope. I can't think of the name of the town that's north of Glenwood Landing. Glen Cove.
Seacliff,
Glen Cove. There's a certain high chunk of land there where my family, my grandfather, way back in the 1900 time frame, used to have a farm. And every one of the lightning storms that came along, one of his barns would be struck and it would catch on fire. And so lightning was really hitting him all the time. So I'm kind of curious where you live, Rich. Also, on this first lightning bolt that you're describing right now, it was standing out in front of the house. Did you see it strike the house? What did you hear? What did you see in front of the house? Back to you, Richie.
No, I didn't see it, but two people across the street did see it hit the antenna. I'm in Mineola, and I'm also about 50 75 feet from the third rail of the Long Island Railroad. Right on the railroad, 50 feet away from me. And there's the Mineola Water Tower, which is very tall. That is about two blocks, not even, block and a half as the crow flies from my house. That has any effect. Not really too many tall trees around. But, no, I didn't see it. The people across the street did see it. And they said it split. It hit the antenna. They could see it. And it also hit something went behind the house, which I'm assuming was the water tower.
Well, let's see now. There was another person trying to sign in. Who was that?
K2YO comment.
Okay, Bernie, we'll pick up with you in a second. You would think with that water tower nearby, Rich, that that would be drawing away an awful lot of the lightning. Altogether, how many times do you think you got struck, Rich?
In the total, since 1972? At least four times.
Okay. And by the way, you live on Searing Avenue. You've had a searing experience. The lightning really sears you quite a bit. Wow. That's really something. Bernie, go right ahead.
Yeah, my 11-meter radio when I was a kid got burnt up, and it was grounded. The antenna was grounded with a blitz bug that time.
Interesting. Go ahead, Bernie, with your comment.
My comment is just a similarity. We got hit about 4 or 6 years ago. I live about 300 yards south of the same tracks that he lives north of. And it hit a big pine tree in our front yard about 10 feet from our house. It did not enter the house. Or the direct hit didn't hit the house. The pulse definitely did and destroyed a bunch of stuff. But I'm just wondering, is there any commonality to those train tracks? Is that a lightning attractor?
That's a tough one. The train tracks are so darn close to the ground except for the... You know, they sometimes elevate the train track on a whole bunch of cinders for a bunch of reasons, but I guess that's to get it away from floods and things like that. But the train tracks are so close to the ground. The ground itself is, by definition, ground. Radio-wise, it's a grounded material, and the train tracks parallel to it. It's hard for me to believe that that's a major factor. If you have a water tower or a radio tower or whatever nearby, yes, that can be a real attractor. It's a pointy metallic object sitting up in the air and it's grounded. That's a real attractor. I'm having trouble believing the railroad tracks are an attractor. But I'm certainly no expert on this one. Lightning is strange stuff. And electrostatic discharge is very strange. The most exciting set of events that I remember seeing was that the company I used to work for manufactured an antenna that was being used in the mountains in Norway. And on this very tall granite mountain, you have this antenna, which was a fiberglass outer tubing that was, I guess, something in the vicinity of a foot in diameter. The antenna itself was something in the vicinity of 20 feet tall. It's mounted on a tower on top of a granite mountain. And boy, when they got struck with lightning, great big hole would be blasted in the side of the fiberglass radome, and the antenna inside would be heavily damaged. And to try to protect that equipment under that environment was a very difficult problem. So there were places in the world where when lightning wants to hit, you're going to have to really suffer unless you do some pretty heroic things. You would think Mineola would not be one of those places. Seacliff or Glen Cove, I can sort of understand where it's on a relatively high piece of land on the northern shore of Long Island, overlooking the Long Island Sound. Just the lay of the land can be a kind of an attractor. And therefore, it is sad that my grandfather never figured out... Let me drop... It is sad that my grandfather never figured out that he should be putting lightning arresters on his wooden barns to stop the fire that happened in every other lightning storm that he happened to encounter in the summertime. And my grandmother, as a result, ended up with an extreme fear of lightning because it was always striking the house and the barns and whatever of her particular farm. And it seemed to her like there was no good escape. And as I said, people didn't understand lightning arresters in those days. And so a proper installation would have made a huge improvement. Modern day buildings are built with all kinds of protection for lightning. And we hear very few events of people in metropolitan areas being damaged by lightning. It isn't that lightning doesn't strike metropolitan areas. I think lightning strikes the Empire State Building, I'm not sure of the exact number, but if someone told me it was 150 times per season, I would believe it. And the building is a steel structure, very well grounded, and has the ability to conduct that lightning very nicely away, and very few of those antennas and pieces of electronics on the Empire State Building ever get damaged by lightning. If Eric happens to be around, he can give us a little bit more information along those lines. Anybody have any further questions or comments on the subject of what John, Bernie, and Richard just brought to our attention with reference to lightning? Give me a call. Let us right now. K2RYW on the TechNet.
Excuse me. This is K2KEY. Go ahead.
Mel recognized. Anyone else?
KC2TME.
KC2. Tango, Mech, Mike, Echo is what it sounded like. Do I have a call that is correct?
That is correct.
And your name is?
Nick.
Okay, sounds like Nick. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, being so close to the ocean here, it seems like this is also a attractive situation for lightning. We've observed, boy, some beautiful bolts of lightning here hitting the ocean down at the corner. And a few of them have worked their way up the block. Top of my tower has been struck a few times. And the only thing I accredit that I've never had any damage to any of my equipment or the tower or whatever, or the antennas, is because I got that desensitizer. I've got that 5 foot of pipe that goes up above the top beam. And on top of that, there's a pin, a very sharp pin, steel pin, that is on top of that pipe, on a cap on top of that pipe, and that pin sticks up above that cap, and it acts as what they call a desensitizer, so that the amount of strike is very, very fine. And they have that on a number of buildings, especially here, the ones along the ocean, that they have these around the periphery of the building, these spikes, these points, and a ground cable connecting them all together down to a ground stakes, Dick, over.
Yeah, you living so near the shore on Dover Street there in Manhattan Beach could certainly see some very nice lightning. It's good that you've taken the right kind of corrective action, and I think you're basically saying you've never suffered any damage. I live on a piece of land 300 feet above sea level, which by Long Island standards in Suffolk County is reasonably high land, carefully chosen by me because I'm a VHF operator, and I wanted high land. And I've got 100 feet of a steel tower sitting on top of that 300 feet piece of land. So I'm an attractor if there ever was one. Back in the days when my 432 Yagi used to be the top thing on the tower, during many of the lightning storms, I would hear all kinds of squealing sounds out of my 432 receiver, because of the corona discharge that was taking place from the elements of that 432 Yagi. And there were times when that noise would get 20 dB over 9. And very interesting sound, that random discharge sound, sizzling sound, so to speak, that you get. And at some later time, I got smart enough to put an extra 5 or 10 feet of mast coming out of the tower that went above that Yagi. So the mast would take the corona discharge instead of the elements of the Yagi. And essentially all of the noise that used to come out of that 432 receiver disappeared. So it's a very smart thing to have some other metallic, well-grounded object higher than your most useful antenna if you want to stop the precipitation noise. There was one other time, let me drop, that I was on top of my tower doing a repair in the wintertime. I was in February, and a snowstorm suddenly came along, and great big snowflakes started coming along unusual snowflakes, great big wide ones. And I noticed that something was hitting me in the back of the head. I couldn't figure out what that was. Actually, my hair was standing on end, and I didn't know it. And pretty soon I looked around, and I saw that the tips of all the antennas that were nearby had this purple glow. And so a high-voltage discharge was slowly happening on the tower that I was standing on. I obviously didn't spend any more time there. I got off in a hurry. No lightning strike occurred at that particular occasion. I did see a lightning bolt strike my tower on one other occasion in the wintertime. I was outside looking up in the air in the dark, and I saw this reasonably small lightning strike hit the top of the tower, and that burned a purple flash into my retina for the next 5 or 10 minutes. And I went outside and was looking at the top of the tower because I was hearing this funny sound coming out of the receiver. Again, a corona discharge happening in the wintertime. Lightning is funny things in funny places. I remember visiting Montreal, Canada in February, way back in 1972, I think it was. And in a snowstorm, I'm in a taxi being transported from the airport to a particular place I was visiting, and I'm hearing thunder. And I'm saying, hey, this is wintertime. What is that sound? And the guy said, it's a thunderstorm. But I said, this is wintertime. He says, yeah. Well, we get thunderstorms in the wintertime here in Montreal, which is a bit strange. I mean, here in the New York City area, we almost never hear thunder in the wintertime. But in Montreal, they do get it. I guess it was Nick that's now going to tell us or ask us a question. Living in Massapequa, where Nick lives, he's reasonably close to the Long Island Sound, Great South Bay. I bet you've seen some interesting lightning events from time to time, Nick. KC2, Tango Mike Echo, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Thundersnow.
Nick, are you there?
Cable came loose.
And to ABG. Go ahead, Dave, tell me what you've seen, because you also live in Massapequa, I think.
I do. Good evening to everybody. I spend a fair amount of time at the beach in the summertime, and I've gotten to know the lifeguards quite well. And when thunderstorms approach, they clear the beach. Everybody has to go back to their cars off the beach for safety reasons because of the lightning. We've all seen lightning strikes during thunderstorms. What I found fascinating, and I saw this myself this last year, was that even after the storm passes and goes out to, wherever it goes and everything clears up, the sun comes out, not a cloud in the sky, out of nowhere, you get a lightning bolt. Just comes down and hits the ground. It scares the bejesus out of you.
So you've seen the bolt out of a clear blue sky, and that was what, like a half hour after the thunderstorm had passed by, Dave? Is that what you're saying? Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe 35, 40 minutes after the storm had cleared the area. And I mean cleared the area. You know, you couldn't even see it anymore. The storm was, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 miles away at that point. The sun is out. You know, it's clear. There's no rain. Everybody's back on the field playing soccer, playing baseball, whatever. And out of nowhere, just this tremendous air-to-ground lightning bolt. Just, all by itself, just one. But you wouldn't want to be anywhere near where that thing hit.
There's also something about the topography of the Bethpage Golf Course, specifically the Black Course. Maybe it's got extra hills or whatever. And golfers are such enthusiastic people that they will sometimes play in the rain, or they'll go into shelter, and as soon as the rain stops, within a few milliseconds, they're back out there playing golf. And it appears to me, having been a caddy way back in the, let me think now, in the 1955 time frame, I was a caddy for two separate years at Bethpage Golf Course. It appeared to me that one or two people died by being struck with lightning on the Black Course every single year. And it's probably not well advertised, but I think that probably is continuing to happen. the combination of people being out there during storms, being overly enthusiastic, having this metallic object in their hand, standing on top of a hill about to hit a golf ball. Sort of an ideal situation, and not an easy one to survive. So something we got to be careful of. When lightning strikes the ground, and if you're standing, let me pick a number, 150 feet away, it creates an E-field across the ground. The ground is not a perfect conductor. It's a kind of a distributed resistor. So if the lightning struck at a point on the ground directly north of where you're standing, and if your 2 feet are aligned north-south, because you're facing the east, and therefore your left-hand foot is going to see a much higher voltage than your right-hand foot, the voltage potential difference across your feet on occasion can be dangerous and or lethal. Cows can be electrocuted, even though the cow is not directly struck. He's being electrocuted through the ground. And people have been struck that way, too. Apparently, the safe thing to do is not to get under a tree, because the tree can be struck. To try to find the lowest point you can and try to stand on 1 foot, or at least put your 2 feet extremely close together. So crouch down in the lowest spot you can find with your feet close together. It can give you the maximum protection because of this distributed E-field effect that happens when lightning strikes the ground. Let's see if Nick has come back. KC2, Tango Mike Echo. Are you there, Nick? K2RIW in the TechNet. I am pretty sure that Nick had some further information or questions for us, but maybe he got called away. Anyone else? Lightning seems to be the subject of discussion tonight. Anyone else with any further stories they would like to relate to us? We'd like to hear them. Further questions, stories, whatever, give me a call that is a name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Now, this is K2KEY. One more thing.
Bell recognized. Anyone else? You're it, Mel. Go right ahead.
Yeah, they had a fatality about, I think it was summer before this, at a place near the Verrazano Bridge. There is a path, a walk path and bicycle path. A young man was riding his bicycle, and he got struck on the head by lightning. Actually, the storm also had cleared out. It was almost sunny again. And where this bolt came down from, nobody knows. And it just, came from nowhere. But that is a funny spot near the Verrazano Bridge, because also been observed there by the Narrows, water spouts. And one of them, one of these twisters that formed these water spouts, of course, came on shore a couple of years ago, and we actually had a tornado in Brooklyn that tore roofs off the houses in that section, Dick. So why are certain areas, more prone to lightning, to these strange natural effects? I don't really, I don't know if there is an answer. I've never heard one that makes sense. Over.
KC2, QIQ.
By the way, I think it was Port Washington where my grandfather lived. I keep getting the town wrong, where his farm was being struck very often. Glenn, go ahead and tell us your lightning story. KC2, QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net. Just an interesting thing. When Mel brought up the story about the bicyclist who got hit, it's a very, very serious thing. I've seen this a lot. I've heard the term used. I'm not sure of the real scientific means behind it, but apparently there's a type of lightning they call ball lightning, which is a little bit different than the types of lightning strikes you see up in high altitude. And it's something that apparently builds up slowly. I've seen it build up even at the beach. And it's a hair-raising kind of a thing, because you can almost visibly see it. If you're watching in the early evening, in dusk, and you look along the seashore from the beach parking lot, you can actually almost see it change color. It starts off a hazy-looking color. It changes very, very rapidly, almost to a yellow-white, and then just snap, and a boom, right there. It's just a very, very bright light, almost right at ground level. Very, very strange effect. I don't know if you've ever seen that. KC2, QIQ.
Happy St. Elmo's fire.
Yeah. Give us a little bit more of a description of that one, Glenn. lightning does slowly build up a stronger and stronger E-field, and it starts sending out these leader strikes, miniature lightning strikes. It turns out a lightning bolt rarely is a single event. It's a whole cascading of events where most of the time, with a negatively charged cloud, the lightning begins leaving the cloud and proceeds in the vicinity of 120 feet and stops. When people have done careful measurements of how much voltage there is in the cloud, and the cloud might be a mile above the land, there's nowhere near enough voltage, 10 to 1 shy of the right amount of voltage, maybe even 100 to 1 shy of the right amount of voltage to arc over the chunk of air between the cloud and the ground. And the lightning doesn't do it all at once. It moves in the steps of 120 feet or so and stops and waits until the next cosmic ray comes along that ionizes a path, and then it jumps through that path, moves another 120 feet, 150 feet, and stops and waits for the next cosmic ray to come along. That's part of the reason why lightning is always zigzagged. These are individual cosmic rays supporting each one of those 120-foot paths, approximately. And sometimes you'll see a lightning bolt looking like an upside-down tree, where some of the branches of the tree never succeeded getting all the way to the ground. One of the other branches became successful in getting to the ground by this step-leader process. So there's multiple steps until the final connection between the cloud and the ground takes place, and then that ionized path supports the real great big bang. So there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on ahead of time. I recognize that I wasn't smart enough to know what I was seeing when I was flying my radio control model airplane on a rainy day in Farmingdale, and as I was doing a wing over with this control line airplane, while the airplane was high in the air, a static charge built up on the two wires came down and arced over the about 4-inch length across the so-called urelium holding onto. It arced from the wire to my hand, made about 3 or 4 snaps, scared the daylights out of me. I let go of the handle. The aircraft crashed, and that probably saved my life, because that was the beginning process before the real lightning bolt was about to come along. So back to you, Glenn. I think you were maybe seeing some of these leading events. You were looking at it edgewise across the waterline, so to speak, before the real bolt came along. And I think you were seeing intermediate ionization, as a guess on my part. KC2QIQ in the group, K2LIW.
KC2QME.
Okay, Nick, we'll get back to you in a second. I'll go right ahead, Glenn.
No, I definitely have to agree, Dick, that, it certainly was a stepping type of an event where you can actually see something. It's not exact. I mean, if there's a storm usually coming in, like a lot of times in a good hot summer's evening, and you have a relatively clear day, and all of a sudden you start seeing a black cloud start coming in over, off of the coastline coming in. So, like, if you look in back of you, you see clear sky. In front of you, you see that very, very dark cloud coming in, that leading edge cloud. And that's usually where I've seen it happen. It's right along that edge. And, boy, you want to take cover if you see that storm start to roll in. I've seen it a couple of times out in a boat, and I really want to rush back into shore before it gets there, even if you just see it out miles and miles away. But you kind of can suspect what's going to happen is that as soon as that storm front just about comes in, it is a building up effect, and it is slow, and sometimes you can even smell the ozone in the air before anything really happens. And it's kind of like a pretty good indicator to get the heck out of there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment?
Richie, stand by. One other quick question there, Glenn. What's the closest any one of these events ever happened to you?
I would say the closest one that I was ever near, and the scariest one, was I was actually driving down Ocean Parkway one day coming back from the Tobey Beach area back towards Wausau Parkway to come back up here to Massapequa. And it was a very, very hard rain coming down to the point that it was rain and fog, where I had to slow down to basically 30 miles an hour, 25 miles an hour, just for the visibility. And I could see lightning in front and back of me. And then there was a big strike and a blinding white light of flash that I couldn't see what direction. It was just all around me. It almost momentarily blinded me. That's how bright it was. and the sound and the light were almost identical. And then it just, you know, it took me like a second just to, you know, recover my vision again, and then just looked around me just to see that nothing had happened. I thought it felt like it struck the car, but it could have been 1,000 feet away for all I know. But that was close enough for me, Vic. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I had something a little bit close to that. One very violent rainstorm with lots of lightning was happening all around me while I was on Route 76, I think it was, in Pennsylvania. And in those days, I had a mag mount on the roof, cable coming through the window, to a handy talkie in my hand, being fed from the cigarette lighter of the car. And this lightning is jumping all over the place, and I'm describing it to people. And I soon realized, wow, if lightning had struck the mag mount on my car and traveled down that piece of cable into the handy talkie in my hand, and my hand is on the steering wheel of the car, I'm reasonably well grounded inside the car with this direct connection to the rubber duck antenna on the roof. I really shouldn't have been doing that. Okay, we're going to pick up Nick and Rich in that order. Nick first. Glad you came back, Nick. KC2TME. Go ahead with your story, your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, I have a lightning story. I have a bicycle with a 10-foot galvanized 1.25-inch mesh on it. After welding it with the support brackets and everything, to the bottom of it's about 15 feet. And I put a mag mount on there. And I rode my bike to Cedar Creek Park one day, and I rode up the hill. Now on this bike, I have guy wires and everything that hooked up to it, so I could be sitting off on the side and supporting itself through windstorms and everything. And I'm up there on Cedar Creek Hill one time, talking on 2 meters. I worked, actually did a little HF on that too. Talked around, you know, the United States with it. It turned, starting to get, you know, the weather started to turn bad, started to get really black. I'm like, uh-oh. Gonna ride home with this thing. Ride home, you know. So I'm like, I'll sit here, sitting there at a table eating a sandwich. Next thing you know, a huge lightning bolt came and struck my bicycle.
What happened to the bicycle? What happened to the equipment? Give us a little bit more description, Nick. Sounds like an interesting episode. Be happy you were not on that bike at the time. You got it, Nick.
The bicycle. It would turn to black. Everything was just, you know, it was like, I don't even know what it was. It was just black, and if you rub my finger against it, my finger turned black. The bicycle seat went on fire, the grips went on fire, the tires were just melted, and, yep, like everything. The wheels, the rim hubs were just, I guess from the arc, like welded the wheels, so it couldn't even move the chain, everything was all welded, like, I guess the lightning did that. I mean, it was crazy. The equipment was fried. Good thing I was sitting underneath that, you know, little overhang.
How far away from you was the equipment connected to that bicycle antenna? And be happy you weren't on the air at the time. How far were you away from the equipment, and how far were you away from the bicycle where you were, Nick? Go ahead.
The table was about 40 feet from the bicycle, and I was sitting on a wood table. Equipment was on the other end of the table. I was sitting on the other end eating a sandwich, and I mean, it was, everything was, I was praying to God that I didn't get struck after that little experience. You know, it was loud. I mean, my ears were ringing. I couldn't hear nothing for like the next couple of days. It was just ring. It was because it was so loud. You know, I had to have some way for the bicycle to cool down because it was, you couldn't, it was so hot you couldn't even touch it. I didn't even want to touch it. And I had to have somebody come, waited there for about 3 hours, and we took the bicycle down and threw it in the back of his pickup truck.
How far was the equipment away from you? There was obviously a cable going from the equipment to the antennas on the bike. Did any arcing take place in the electronics that was on the other end of the table that you were at eating your sandwich? Did you see anything funny happening with the radio equipment when you looked in that direction, Nick? Go ahead.
Oh, the radio had smoke coming out of it. out of the holes in the side and the back, smoke was, black smoke was pouring out. I didn't even open up the inside of the radio. I just threw it out. The power supply was, you know, done. I had a battery hooked up to a, you know, in a power inverter. And then my power supply was hooked up to the power inverter, and then that's how I powered my radio. Everything was garbage. You know, the battery was melted, you know, just, you know, I put a lot of time into that bicycle, you know, all the right metal, brackets, bolts, you know, bought this special type of welding wire. It was garbage.
And once again, the antenna that was connected to the bicycle, the top of that antenna was roughly how many feet off the ground, Nick?
To the top, about 20 feet, to the tip of the magnet. And, you know, my ground was my guy wires. I got steel wire from work, and that's how I, you know, supported it. I didn't have to, you know, hold it there, nothing. I supported itself, and that was my ground and my, stabilizer. And then, you know, the ground didn't help. Still fried up everything, you know. Radios are garbage. It was lucky I didn't get struck that night. You know, somebody was watching out for me.
I presume those ground wires, those wires that were acting as guy wires, went, let's say, 10 feet away from the bicycle and were into stakes in the ground. Is that the way you did that, sir? Nick, go ahead.
Yeah, bought a little, you know, like a 2-pound sledgehammer, and I slammed them into the ground. You know, they had like a special loop on the end, and I got these special cable, you know, clamps that, so it locked, you know, I bolted the cable together with special clamps, so, you know, when I was done operating, I rolled it up, you know, I had a little pouch on the side of it, like a Velcro pouch, and I put everything in there that was strapped around the poles, but, you know, stakes were about each 3 feet long. There was four, you know, four wires.
What kind of wire? And did the wire become vaporized or damaged? Was the wire reusable after the event? Go ahead.
Yeah, the antenna was damaged. I used 2-gauge steel wire. Got it from work. We were going to get rid of it.
And what happened to the 2-gauge steel wire that was used as guy wires?
It turned black. It was okay. Didn't melt or nothing. You know, it was solid. You know, it was not solid. It was like, you know, strands of 2-gauge. It was, stuff was perfect. And, you know, that was okay. That, nothing happened to that. You know, that's very thick, and that was the only thing that was worth saving.
Was the 2-gauge wire stranded steel wire, flexible stranded steel wire, or was it a solid piece of wire? Go ahead.
It was stranded, you know, thick pieces combined together. It was strong. It was okay, though, you know. I took that off. I got my bolt cutters, and I cut it. You know, I didn't want to throw that stuff away. You know, that stuff's expensive if I had to go buy it.
So when you had this bicycle set up as a mast with four guy wires into stakes in the ground, and your top mag mount antenna was 20 feet above the ground, when you took that all apart and you're ready to ride on the bicycle under normal conditions, how high would any of those pipes be above the ground while you're riding on the bicycle? Now back to you, Nick.
Well, support, you know, the mast itself, after it was raised up with all the support bars and everything that were welded to the bicycle frame, it stood 15 feet, and then it had a 5-foot mag mount. So, with the mag mount off, it was 15 feet.
So you're telling me that when you would drive that bicycle, there would be in behind you a mast 15 feet above the ground. You'd have to be very careful of where you ride that bicycle. If you drove under a tree, for instance, those masts would be hitting the a branch of the tree. Isn't that true?
It's very true. I was going under a bridge one time. Hold on a second. I was going under a bridge one time, and the bridge was only 11 feet high, and I didn't realize it, and the pole smacked the bridge Hold on 1 second. Dick, I have a landline.
Okay. In the meantime, we'll pick up with Richie. Rich, KC2LTY, go right ahead with your question, comment, whatever. You got it, Rich.
Yeah. When lightning strikes, you get a smell of ozone, correct?
Whenever you have an electrical discharge in air, you will smell ozone. When I run my Wimhurst machine or my Van de Graaff generator, you smell a lot of ozone. Even in some cases around the television set, the high voltage that goes to the cathode ray tube, you'll occasionally smell ozone. Go ahead, Rich.
Well, okay, this summer once, last summer twice, on lightning strikes. I have the windows open, I can smell the ozone. I have one of those electronic air cleaners. And those things give off an ozone odor, too. I know what the ozone odor smells like. So, I've smelled ozone on lightning strikes lots of times.
And so, I think you're saying Mineola has that problem. Interesting. Those electronic air cleaners that do give you the smell of ozone, you've got to be a little bit careful with those. A friend of mine developed a strong allergy to ozone and developed some fairly serious health effects that I think the ozone air cleaner was aggravating. Ozone is a very corrosive material. When it strikes your moist lung material, it makes an acid, which can give you some grief. So some of those ozone high-voltage air cleaning devices are not as safe as you would like to believe. Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, well, it's a lot safer than breathing in asbestos, I'll tell you that.
Okay, I think you're saying you wanted to clean out any asbestos that might be in the air of your house. You have an older house where some of the pipes are insulated with asbestos?
No, I was a boiler mechanic for 25 years. That's irrelevant.
Yeah, and if you were, as a boiler mechanic, being exposed to asbestos dust, that's not good. And if you happen to be a smoker at the same time, there's a significant amount of evidence that says a person exposed to asbestos dust and being a smoker simultaneously can run into some pretty serious health problems. Let's hope you were not a smoker at that time. Is that true, Rich?
That's probably a pretty good reason why I can't breathe anymore.
Okay, I think you're telling me that you might have some emphysema as a result of those two exposures, Rich?
Maybe a little more than that.
I think you're telling me it's been diagnosed, and I think what little I know is there's no real good cure for that. I think there's no pharmaceutical that can really help an emphysema condition. Am I somewhat right on that one, Rich?
Yeah, it's correct. It's a one-way ticket.
What, from your experience, Rich, is the rough approximate loss in lung capacity that becomes the threshold of grief? In other words, my understanding is that a normal human being could lose almost 50% of his lung capacity, and as long as he's not a marathon runner, he would almost not feel the effects. But there's some number above that where all of a sudden life becomes kind of difficult. From your experience, or from the articles you've read or the people you've talked to, what percentage of lung capacity loss is the threshold of grief for normal living in modern-day society? How about you, Rich?
I get up to take a piss and I'm out of breath.
Yeah, but have you ever been diagnosed as a certain percentage? Do you know roughly what your percentage of loss might have been? Has anyone ever estimated that?
No, I never looked and never went to a doctor on that end, no. But it's getting worse and worse. And it's like having pneumonia, only it's getting worse and worse.
I presume you're under a physician's care where he can make sure the condition is not accelerating. Is that somewhat true, Rich?
No, negative.
Okay. In your opinion, is that wise? Although maybe there's no glamour fix if you went to a physician, but still, I think you'd like to be under a physician's care to make sure the condition doesn't accelerate, because an accelerating condition could be a bit unpleasant. If I probably don't have to tell you that. How about you, Rich?
There's no cure. I'm taking it day by day.
Okay. Good luck with that, sir. Anyone else with any further questions or comments? Lightning seems to be the subject we're discussing tonight. An exciting subject. Bright idea. What a flash of a subject we're talking about. Anyone else with any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else?
And so APG.
And Dave recognized. Anyone else? Okay, we got to periodically wait until the machine thoroughly resets. You got it, Mel.
Okay, you said when lightning strikes, the ozone is sometimes very noticeable in the air. I guess that's why maybe we should say that after a storm, that the air smells great. Now, you mentioned the air purifiers. I have one. We have one here in the kitchen that works on that principle, and I heard things about it in the last number of years about that ozone generating system that they use in there with a high voltage and that these little canisters in there, and we don't turn it on anymore. So I do know, at least that's what I heard, that definitely ozone does destroy rubber. Is that correct? Over.
Yeah, ozone is a very active material, and particularly when it's mixed with moisture, I think it becomes an acid, and I know it can be quite destructive to lung material. So these electrostatic cleaners, I'm not sure whether or not, if they're well-maintained or not well-maintained, do they generate more or less ozone. And a little bit of ozone maybe is not bad, but a significant amount, and I'm not quite sure where the threshold of that is. I know that continuously smelling ozone can be destructive. As I said, I've got a friend who used to use one of those electrostatic air cleaners, and it was giving him some very serious health effects, which he eventually discovered and stopped using it. So they're not all safe, and anybody who wants to use one of those or is using one of those, I do recommend you research it further. Because I think they can either be dangerous by original design or become dangerous depending on how they're maintained. Maybe particles of dust in there that arrange themselves in a certain position create more ozone, and therefore it becomes a more destructive machine. So I worry about those. I'm concerned, and I do recommend you give it serious consideration before you use them day in and day out. I wonder if you've got one of those high-voltage air cleaners, Dave, and 2APG, K2RIW.
And 2APG. No, I do not. My comments are not related to lightning, so I don't know if you have a list of people you want to put me on the end of the list or you want to take it now, whatever is your pleasure.
We're going to take you right now. Go ahead, Dave, and give a little bit of delay before you start.
Alrighty, that's 2APG. You probably weren't watching 60 Minutes tonight because I know you were on the TechNet. And this is an admission, I wasn't listening to the whole TechNet because I was watching 60 Minutes tonight. They had a very interesting spot on the program, and rather than go into the whole thing yet, let me just ask you, are you familiar with Mr. John Kanzius?
Yes, I believe Leslie Stahl was going to interview him tonight. It was announced on the Limark website or the emails that are issued to Limark members. And I believe this is the third in the series of Leslie Stahl interviewing this man, because he has discovered by ham radio procedure, I'm going to call it, that when you apply RF energy with the right kind of other apparatus to a cancer, that you can definitely affect a partial cure or maybe even a cure. So when it comes to curing certain kinds of cancer, it looks like this K3, and I can't remember his call, it is radio amateur, is doing some really good work. And I think 60 Minutes and Leslie Stahl was interviewing him for the third time. So hopefully you've seen the show. Please describe what you saw. Give me the call letters of the man's name. And what was it like? I didn't get a chance. I was at a birthday celebration at that time. You got it, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW.
All right, well, hopefully there's a way to, you know, maybe see that particular programming on the Internet. I don't know if that's possible, but it wouldn't surprise me. This is the first time that I had knowledge about this ham. You're right, Leslie Stahl had interviewed him two prior times. This was apparently the third one. He's now a silent key. He had leukemia. And he started to treat himself with some sort of RF, you know, energy to try to cure his leukemia. Fascinating story. Apparently the research is continuing. There's a physician that's continuing to do the research, and it's very promising. They're showing that they're able to actually kill cancer cells using RF energy.
Yeah, I believe both him and other people researching this have discovered that there are certain kinds of particles that under certain conditions you can make those particles attract themselves to a cancer, and then by using local RF heating with radio energy, you can more selectively heat the cancer compared to the normal cell, the normal tissue that's around it. And the one thing that many cancers are vulnerable to is extra heating. And so if you can create extra heating of the cancer compared to the tissue around it, you can selectively destroy the cancer. And this hopefully is a good cancer cure. When it comes to certain kinds of localized cancer, skin cancer and cancer of a particular organ, I think this can have a lot of effect. Leukemia, or at least some of the kinds of leukemia, which is a general leukemia of the cells of the blood, which goes everywhere in the body. Now that's a much more difficult thing to cure, as I see it. That kind of cancer is spread all over the place, and to selectively cure the cancerous cells in your bloodstream and leave the regular cells alone, I think that's a much more difficult problem. So although he passed away and wasn't successful, that doesn't mean he doesn't have a darn good idea. I think that's my impression. And you've seen the program. I haven't. Correct me on that one. And I'm relatively sure that CBS Television does have a website we can go to in which we can scan the past episodes of 60 Minutes. I believe there is such a program or such a website. N2APG, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, N2APG. The ending of the interview, you were left with a positive note, because the doctor that's still using his quote-unquote machine, you know, doing more experimentation, again, said that he had a, at this point, he was looking at a 100% kill rate regarding killing the cancer cells that they were experimenting with. You know, using the RF energy. So it's a fascinating story. Like I said, tonight was the first time I had ever seen it. I wasn't aware of it before. His call sign was K3TUP, Tango Uniform Papa, I believe. Like I said, you know, this is hopefully will be some sort of a positive thing for cancer patients. And also it's a, you know, it's a good thing for amateur radio.
Yeah, RF energy is capable of being very nicely focused, and as such, as a aid to curing cancer, it sure looks like it has a lot of potential that hasn't been investigated enough in the past, and it will be investigated in the future. It's too bad that Tango Uniform Papa, K3TUP, didn't get a chance to carry it through. Anyone else with any further questions or comments on any subjects that can be used on the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
K2RIW. I had a question. I was the last one on the list.
And we didn't get to you, Rich. We're going to get to you right now. Before we do, there was one other person trying to sign in. Who was that?
K2YL.
And Bernie. Okay. We shouldn't have passed over, Rich. We talked to you so often, Rich, we thought we had handled you. KC2LTY. The RF voice of Mineola. Go right ahead, Rich. K2LIW.
The lightning voice of Sharon Avenue. Now, my question is, supposing you had 75 feet of 9913 coax. That was too short to get to your shack. So you take a barrel connector and another piece of coax. Say 118 or something else, 213. Now you're mixing, and you're using a barrel connector. Are you going to have any type of SWR problems? You are going to increase the loss, overheating, fires, any type of problems, as if it was just one solid piece of cable?
Absolutely, positively not. As long as you're mixing together pieces of cable of the same characteristic impedance, even though they've got different diameters, different brand names, different velocity factors, different dielectric constant of the materials or whatever. If I took a piece of 1 5/8 Andrew Heliax airline, and halfway up to the tower, halfway up to the antenna, I convert over to a piece of RG214, RG213, RG8-like coax cable, with the right kind of an interfacing connector. Absolutely no problem. The RF energy doesn't know the difference. It's flowing down one piece of 50-ohm cable and going into another piece of 50-ohm cable. You'd be amazed how many people are scared to death about putting connectors anywhere in the system. A modern-day high-performance VHF station should have a piece of flexible coax cable that is not foam-filled, like RG8, RG213, RG214, to go from the antenna and around the rotator, a flexible piece of cable that's got solid polyethylene dielectric so that it can't suck up water. And you've only got a few feet of it to go around the rotator. Let me drop. Then you make a transition over to your hard line, because the hard line has got the lowest loss you can get for a particular diameter. And you run the rest of the cable from the top of the tower over to the shack with hard line. Then depending on how you bring the hard line into the house, you may have another flexible piece of cable. So you could have flex, hard line, flex, interfacing connectors, whatever. It'll work like a charm. The only problem you've got when you've done those interruptions is to do a good job of weatherproofing those bullet connectors. Each one of those connectors is a source of potential water ingressing into the system. Other than that, no problem. 9913, the original air-filled version of it, was notorious for sucking up water. So you'll worry about that a little bit. And properly weatherproofing that is very, very difficult. The more modern version, 9914, I think it is, has got a foil layer under the polyethylene jacket, which gives you a much better weatherproofing. But the earlier versions of 9913 were kind of famous for sucking up water. An awful lot of hams have come to the conclusion that any interruption in the system is bad, and they try to run one single piece of flexible cable from the antenna all the way to the back of the rig. You don't have to be anywhere near that severe, as long as you can properly insulate the, properly weatherproof those connections. Now let me give you another example.
Zach, all of the extensions are indoors. The cables from the antenna, they all make it into the house before they're spliced together with the barrel connectors.
No problem at all. You don't even have to worry about weatherproofing in that case. The 9913 itself, it goes outside the house. You do have to worry a little bit about that. It is capable of sucking up water and developing a terrible amount of loss that doesn't show. It happens very slowly, and you get used to it, so to speak. So the old-fashioned 9913, do worry about getting water into it. And the water can slowly migrate over the years through the polyethylene jacket, even if you've done a perfect job of weatherproofing each of the ends of the cable that are outdoors. Now, there are guys who get a hold of some very low loss cable, cable TV type hardline cable, but it's 70 ohms. And they think if they mix a piece of 70 ohm cable with a piece of 50 ohm cable, that the whole antenna system is going to explode. No way in hell is that anywhere near that bad.